This is the Winchester Talking Newspaper for the week ending Friday the 30th of August 2024. Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Hampshire Chronicle from the Winchester and District Talking Newspaper. Now, may I introduce our readers for this week, Deborah Cranmer.
Hello.
Richard Martin.
Hello.
And we welcome a new member to our team this week, Jackie Dunlan.
Hello.
And I'm your presenter, Peter Lydiard. Well, so we begin with our usual regular notices. The first is to say, if you know someone who is sight impaired and would like to receive our recordings, or if you have a problem with a recording that you have received from us, please contact us on 01962 861229. That is 01962 861229. And this number can also be found on the key fob attached to your memory stick. As you listen to the recordings, remember you can use the buttons on your box to move on from an item before it finishes or back to any of the tracks if you want to listen again. And those of you with computers or tablets, apart from using the memory stick in the box provided, you can load it onto your own device. You can also access the weekly recording of the Chronicle through our website, www.winchestertalkingnews.com. You just go to the website, click on News on the header bar, locate the recording you want to hear, and click Download. And the recordings are listed in date order, with the most recent first on the list. You can also hear Winchester Talking Newspaper on AWAS Community Radio every Saturday at 5 p.m. AWAS Radio is on the DAB channel. Just retune your DAB radio and search for AWAS. And you can also listen to us reading the news as a podcast via the Hampshire Chronicle website. Right, and so on with our usual headline stories. The first is residents in fear over losing homes. Deborah, please.
Yes, Housing Association sends eviction notices. I'm not moving. They'll have to lift me out of this place. Those are the words of a Winchester resident who is one of four that could be forced to leave their home due to a no-fault eviction order. Those living at the property in St John's Road have spoken of the shock of receiving the Section 21 no-fault eviction notice from Bournemouth Churches Housing Association, BCHA, which is trying to dispose of its Winchester assets. One resident, Sharon May, has lived at the property for 7 years. Mrs. May told the Chronicle that the notice was served in June but has now expired. BCHA will need to serve a new notice to follow it through. She said, when we were given the notice, they, BCHA, said it was going to be a property inspection, but it turned out they handed us the Section 21 order. We haven't heard from them since. I've been ringing and emailing them for the last 6 weeks and they just fobbed me off. It was a shock for us. Mrs. May said, it was a shock for us because we weren't really expecting it. It's not nice, especially with the lack of communication. There hasn't been an explanation. She is in an unusual situation because she owns 5 acres of land in Sparsholt, which currently has livestock and agricultural buildings on it. She added, I can't be put on the housing list because I have land in Sparsholt, because they're saying I can sell my land to purchase a property, but I can't because it's against the law. It would be money laundering. The council can either house me or give me planning permission. I've not been offered any alternative accommodation at all. I am quite lucky because I've got the yard where I can go to take out my frustrations. I work and keep busy. Nobody should be made homeless because of a no-fault eviction order. We've been dropped like a stone. Another resident who didn't want to be named said, my anxiety has hit the roof. It has just engulfed me. I've been very happy here. It's been really affecting me. I just want to stay here. I'm not moving. They'll have to lift me out of this place. Residents have sought assistance from former City Councillor Ian Tate, who also helped Jonathan Marsh, who'd been faced with 4 no-fault eviction notices from BCHA from a property in Sussex Street. Mr. Tate said, "The council should be liaising with other housing providers, and they should do a seamless transfer from Bournemouth Churches Housing Association to another. All the people would stay in situ." A BCHA spokesman said, "Our lease agreement has ended, and the property is returning back to Winchester City Council's stock list. BCHA is committed to the well-being of our residents and is working with Winchester City Council to ensure the transition to new accommodation is as smooth as possible. The process for an offer of accommodation requires the engagement of the customer so that Winchester City Council Housing Options team can assess the individual's need and make an appropriate offer of accommodation. Although the statutory duty to rehouse the residents affected by this rests with Winchester City Council, BCHA continues to offer support to our residents."
Thank you, Deborah. Richard, your headline story, please.
Well, on a similar theme, really, council spends £1 million repurchasing homes. Winchester City Council has spent more than £1 million purchasing former right-to-buy properties, new figures reveal. Excuse me. Right-to-buy legislation allows people renting local authority-owned homes to buy them at a discounted rate. It was introduced by Margaret Thatcher in the 1980s. But radar analysis of freedom of information requests shows many councils have ended up buying back properties that they had previously sold at a discount through the scheme, with a total of £1.7 billion spent across England. More than £1 billion of this has been spent since the start of 2020. It's difficult to say whether home buying has intensified over this time period, as many councils do not provide figures from more than 5 or 10 years ago. The figures show Winchester City Council has spent £1.3 million on 6 right-to-buy properties, all of which were bought from 2020 onwards. Excuse me again. Across England, 8,600 homes sold under right-to-buy have been subsequently purchased by local authorities, 5,900 of them since 2020. Harry Quilter Pinner, Executive Director of the Institute of Public Policy Research, said, "The scale of councils selling off properties only to buy them back a few years later highlights the absurdity of the austerity years. Selling low, buying high, short-term savings at the expense of long-term costs, penny wise, but pound foolish. As the consequences now come to bear, and councils struggle with related symptoms of the housing crisis like rising homelessness, it's crucial that the Westminster government thinks long-term and provides sustainable funding settlements for local authorities so they can avoid this situation happening again. The data comprises freedom of information responses from 117 councils, 111 of which were able to provide data on how much they'd spent. Many of the biggest spenders were in London. Islington Council has spent the most at a total of £146 million. It was followed by Lambeth, which spent £112 million, while Barnet, Haringey and Brighton and Hove have each spent more than £80 million. Across England, 23 councils have spent more than £10 million each since 2020. Councillor Claire Holland, housing spokesperson for the Local Government Association, explained that councils legally have to sell housing stock at a significantly discounted price, starting at 35% for houses and 50% for flats. Councils have a right of first refusal if the buyer wants to sell, but this is invariably more than they originally sold it for. With councils spending vast sums on costly temporary accommodation due to the shortage of social housing, they look for ways to increase their stock, which includes buying back previous council housing," she said.
Thank you, Richard. Jackie, your headline story, please.
Yes, I have. Councillor urges bus firm to rethink cuts. the leader of Hampshire County Council is urging a bus provider to think again after it cut services to a sixth form college in Winchester. Stagecoach recently announced that from September, they are axing a raft of routes to Peter Simmons College. The County Council is responsible for transport for people up to 16 years old, but not after that. Councillor Nick Adams-King said, "Hampshire County Council has no role to play in either arranging or subsidising transport to college for those in post-16 education. That is entirely a matter for the colleges and the bus companies. We continue to urge the college and Stagecoach to find a solution to this challenge, which threatens to exclude many of those young people living in Eastleigh and rural Test Valley from the opportunity of studying at Peter Simmons College. The services being cut are Old Alsford, currently 64X, nearest bus will be service 64 from New Alsford, White Parish and West Wellow, currently 66.2. Nearest bus will be service 66 from Romsey. Knoll Village, currently 691. Nearest bus will be service 69 from Wickham. Hatch Warren and Worting, currently 86. Local buses run to Basingstoke Railway Station. Penwood and Wash Common, currently 86. No replacement. Newbury and Kingsclear, currently 86. Service 32 runs to Basingstoke Railway Station. Lodgers Hall and Weyhill, currently 851. Use Active 8 into Andover and change to service 74/75. And Lords Hill, North Baddersley and Valley Park, currently 461. No replacement. In a letter to students, staff and parents, James O'Neill, Commercial Director of Stagecoach South, said, "Most college bus services have been busy this year with high numbers of students travelling. However, a few routes have unfortunately carried far smaller numbers. As the buses operate on a commercial basis, relying on ticket sale income without subsidy, this means now some now run at an unsustainable loss, totalling over £200,000 in the year. The bus industry continues to face challenging costs, particularly for parts, materials and staffing, which are expected to continue to rise at above inflationary rates for the year ahead. This has made it very challenging to cover the running cost of college buses, especially longer distance routes, where the only income is collected through student ticket sales. To address this unsustainable financial loss, we need to make a number of changes for September. We're very sorry for the impact these changes will have on students at the stops we can no longer serve."
Thank you, Jackie. My headline piece is "Cathedral install netting due to falling mortar pieces." Netting has been installed in Winchester Cathedral after the vaulted ceiling over the nave began to crumble. 2 weeks ago, on Friday, August the 9th, some pieces of mortar from previous repair work fell down from the vault near the stained glass window by the cathedral entrance. No one was hurt, and an expert confirmed that the ceiling's original stone was fully intact before the netting was installed and the reception desk has been slightly rearranged. The cathedral released the following statement. "Further inspection later last Friday revealed that it wasn't stone from the building, but just a few pieces of mortar from an old repair that had fallen. Thanks to the prompt action of cathedral staff, we were able to get the netting up quickly to ensure the safety of everyone entering the building. Reception desk has also been slightly rearranged. More inspection work was carried out yesterday, and it revealed that the mortar came from a window repair on the south side of the cathedral. Work now begins to inspect the rest of the windows in that part of the cathedral further to identify any other similar mortar repairs that may need attention. In the meantime, the netting will stay in place until the full assessment has been completed." The Chronicle contacted the cathedral for further comment. Right, well, that is the headline story. As we now move on to the death notices, starting with Deborah, please.
Arnold, Dennis Edward Arnold, peacefully at Winchester Hospice, aged 91.
Campbell, Peter MacLeod Campbell, helicopter pilot and aviation consultant, unexpectedly at the Royal Hampshire County Hospital on the 10th of August, aged 80.
Cox, Wendy Wentworth Cox, peacefully, 21st of August, aged 83.
Garabetti, Levon Gregor Garabetti, peacefully, 9th of August, aged 88.
Lipscomb, Barry David Lipscomb, Mayor of Winchester from 2011 to 12, at Royal Hampshire County Hospital on the 16th of August, aged 81.
Mort David Mort, peacefully in his sleep on the 20th of August, following a short illness.
Mundy, Valerie Ann Mundy, peacefully at Royal Hampshire County Hospital, 5th of August, aged 81.
Oakley, Patricia Oakley, known as Pat, peacefully at Brendan Care, St Giles View, 7th of August, aged 93.
Silk, Susan Mary Dunbar Silk, known as Sue, at home on the 15th of August.
Stevens, Terry Stevens, formerly of Courtney Road, Winchester, in Cardigan, Wales, on the 10th of August, aged 84.
Thank you. Now we move on to Christian comment, read today by Jackie, please.
Love, effort and faith, all that matter. One of her biographers said, if Dorothy Day is ever canonised, she would be the patron saint not only of homeless people and those who try to care for them, but also of people who lose their temper. She is little known over here, but Dorothy Day was famous in the USA during the 20th century. She was a pacifist, an activist, a devout Catholic, someone who was ready to go to jail for her principles. She was a co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement, editing and publishing a Catholic newspaper, and also opening Houses of Hospitality to help down and outs in New York initially. She oversaw the creation of other such locations all over the world. Some of them still exist. She was born in 1897, and what she achieved in the next 83 years is astonishing. Reading her biography, as I have just done, Dorothy Day, Dissenting Voice of the American Century by John Loughery and Blythe Randolph, is by turns jaw-dropping and horrifying and inspiring and heartwarming. Her houses of hospitality could be terrifying places. No one was turned away, and what others would see as the dregs of humanity turned up there. She insisted that every individual was treated with love and respect. The houses could be noisy, dangerous, dirty places. Many, many young people and religious came to spend time there to help. Some could only take it for a short time, but Dorothy Day lived and died in her houses for 50 years. Her life was ascetic and lived in poverty. She was a very devout Catholic, going to Mass every day, but at the same time was forever falling out with senior clerics who often disapproved of her left-wing beliefs. At the same time, those who supported her for her political views could not understand how she could go along with the church's rigid policies on sexuality and birth control. She could be difficult or even impossible to work with, but nobody could doubt her commitment, her passion, and her essential goodness. She tried to embrace compassion, self-sacrifice, simplicity, and prayerful community. When things were going badly, and they often did, she said they must always continue with their work. They must bring love and care to people. It didn't matter if those people responded badly, like the woman who, at one of the farm communes they ran, volunteered to do the shopping and took $200 and the car and was never seen again. It didn't matter. The process is underway to have her declared a saint. She would probably have no time for that. Her view was, that's the way people try to dismiss you. If you're a saint, then you must be impractical and utopian, and nobody has to pay any attention to you. But it would make her better known and remembered, and that has to be a good thing. She was a quite extraordinary person, and most people would be unable to follow in her footsteps to any degree. She led such an uncompromising and hard life. And yet, as you think of how far your own life is from hers, you can still remember this from her philosophy. In the end, love, effort, and faith are all that matter. We can all try a bit harder. And that was by Moira Redmond.
Thank you, Jackie. Now we go on to letters to the editor, starting with Richard, please.
Minster Gem. The news report, Student Reconstructs Old Minster, Chronicle Author 22nd, highlights the potential of Newbury's work developing this new way of presenting multi-phase buildings, especially interestingly since he has applied it to Winchester's iconic Old Minster. The image shown in your report of New Minster, with Old Minster behind, was skillfully created by Simon Hayfield, using the findings from Bert and Martin Biddle's groundbreaking excavations in the 1960s. That illustration and many others are contained in The Search for Winchester's Anglo-Saxon Minsters, Archaeo Press 2018. This gem of a book is available via www.archaeopress or from the usual sources. A book to treasure at only £15. And that's from Barbara Bryant, Chair of the Winchester Excavations Committee.
Thank you, Richard. Jackie, please.
So where are all the women? From Verity Coleman. I support a gathering in solidarity with Muslims in our community, particularly in the aftermath of the national riots, reported in the Chronicle August 15th. I wonder, however, if a woman's view would be welcomed when I look at your photograph showing 8 men on the stage and a sizeable audience of men only, with no women in view. Were women excluded? And that's from Verity Coleman, Martyrworthy Road, Abbotsworthy in Winchester.
Jackie, my letter is written by Graham Ryder and it's headed A Disgrace. I must agree with Dr. Tony Saunders in his letter, Chronicle, August the 15th, where he states that Winchester bus station is a disgrace. When the bus station was first taken over by Winchester City Council, at a cost to the residents, a number of improvements were made and widely heralded. Sadly, these did not include rain shelters, which were installed much later. So small, only a couple of people can shelter under them, and if the wind is in the wrong direction, it'd have no value at all. Missing litter bins, which must have been outside of the budget, were substituted with black bin bags cable tied to the railings. The bus stand identities were marked on the concrete where the bus stood, so it was only possible to know which bus stand was which after the bus had gone. This was resolved by printing the identities A, B, C, etc. on A3 paper, laminated and cable-tied to the railings. There is very limited seating, some of which is carefully positioned just to the side of the nearest shelter. The vegetation behind the entrance sign was not cleared. On a recent visit, it was quite clear the bus station has received no TLC in a very long time. Gutters were blocked. Providing ample nesting material for the pigeons. The paint on the railings is all but completely peeled off. Likewise, much of the paint on the walls has flaked off and been left on the floor, where it fell. I doubt that the area has seen a broom in action in years, perhaps since being taken into Winchester City Council ownership. The concreted, oblique, asphalted bus road area is an uneven mishmash of differently poorly maintained surface finishes, potholes and faded markings. NB, there is no pedestrian crossing marked at the entrance to the bus station. I find it amazing that the then newly owned and improved bus station got an award. I wonder what it was for and who by. Clearly, the adjudicators had never been to the bus station or ever travelled by bus. I hope that the recently proclaimed adjoining recreational space created on the site of the old Friarsgate Health Centre will not suffer from being awarded an accolade following similar utter neglect. Given the opportunities presented to the planning department by this site to create a valued, architecturally interesting design consistent with the neighbouring historical buildings, Café Oblique shop, on the same side as the passengers, weatherproof, inviting and providing a practical bus station worthy of the gateway to the county town of Hampshire and one-time capital of England. What happened? So that was written by Graham Ryder of Prizedean Road, Hairstock. Please.
The next letter is from R.F. Young, and this is entitled I Saw Sight. I'm writing about the development of approximately 10 dwellings constructed possibly 5 or 10 years ago at the bottom of Stanmore Lane on the right, just before the railway bridge. I first noticed these properties during lockdown, when I was recovering from a hip replacement and walking around the area. At that time, I believe the development was virtually complete, but vandals had started to break all of the windows that they could see, and the complete area was padlocked. I imagine that the developers went bankrupt at that time, and the entire site continues to be locked up, and no work is being undertaken. I would have hoped that Winchester City Council could establish the facts regarding this development and put those 10 dwellings to good use. Surely an offer to the developers or their receivers could be made when the site could be opened up, the houses and flats refurbished, and 10 families housed. It would be better that the council commence the work for the benefit of the city rather than another developer being involved, and I would have thought that an offer of £1 to £2 million for the entire site would have been useful to the receivers in settling some of the bankrupt company's debts. If the properties were then refurbished at a cost of, say, £100,000 to £150,000 each, the resulting completed development would become a useful addition to the city's housing stock. The site is currently a complete eyesore, occupying as it does a scrap of land between an electricity substation, the main railway line, and the edge of the Badger Farm estate. R.F. Young, Barley Down Drive, Badger Farm.
Thank you, Deborah. Richard, please.
And John Murray here has some things to get off his chest as well. Recollections may differ, he says. I read with interest the letter in the Hampshire Chronicle of August the 22nd from Mike Biden. We are of the same age, though I will admit to being older than him and have lived in Winchester all my life. He seems to see the world through rose-coloured glasses, as my memory is somewhat different to his. I do not remember free school meals unless there were special circumstances. When I was at primary school, the weekly charge was 0.5 crown, 2 and 6p, and when my brother joined me, the cost was 4 and 6p. I remember free milk at primary school, 1/3 of a pint if I remember, but Margaret Thatcher, when she was Education Secretary, stopped it. Thatcher, the milk snatcher. Secondary school children stopped getting free milk around 1968 and primary schools in 1971, unless under 7 years. University fees were generally free, but subject to parental assessment. So if your parents' income was above a certain level, then they had to make a contribution. University places were fought over, stiff competition, and many pupils did not go to university, rather apprentices, or if taking higher education to college or polytechnic. House prices were definitely cheaper when he and I got married. Not to each other. But we had interest rates as high as 15 to 16%. MIRAS was introduced in 1983, and by the time it was withdrawn by Gordon Brown in 2000, it was down to 10% relief, so it was short-lived. 17 years. Then we come on to pensions. Following Gordon Brown's budget in 1997, in which he raided pension schemes by taking away their ability to reclaim the tax credit on dividends, this single act resulted in the demise of the final salary pension scheme, unless you're in the public sector, civil service, local government, NHS, etc., where you still benefit at the taxpayers' expense as we pay the employer's contributions. In my experience, not many people employed in the private sector have a final salary pension, more likely an inferior defined scheme, usually insurance-based. There are many without private pensions of any kind, or very small ones, which makes them ineligible for pension credit, who will suffer. There are others who, because of medical conditions, have to keep their home really warm, who are grateful of the winter fuel allowance, and are worried about the cost of fuel this coming winter with the cap about to be raised. He then talks about those coming out of university saddled with debt. He fails to mention that most of this debt will never be recovered, nor that if you have a real degree, starting salaries being offered to graduates by some professional firms are at levels most of us could only dream about. John Murray, Burley Road, Hairstock.
Jackie, please.
I don't have a title for this letter, but it's about winter fuel allowance and pension credit, and it's from Andrew Beadle. Your correspondent, Mike Biden, Chronicle August 22nd, supports the new government's plan to withdraw winter fuel payments from pensioners who are not on pension credit. There are estimated to be 2 million pensioners who either do not claim pension credit, although eligible, or who are just above the income threshold. These pensioners will suffer real hardship this winter, especially now the energy price cap is being increased. Unfortunately, many low-income pensioners do not realise they might be eligible for this credit. I think Danny Chambers could perform a valuable service by publicising pension credit in his next communication to constituents. The pension credit helpline can be contacted on 0800 99 1234. A friend or relative can phone if necessary, and they can fill in an application over the phone. And that's from Andrew Beadle, Milesdown Place, St Giles Hill, Winchester.
Thank you, Jackie. Now, my letter is allegedly written by somebody called Peter Lydiard. And as I'm Peter Lydiard, probably I ought to read it. And it's headed, Great Show. Congratulations to the Nutshell Jazz Club for not only another great jazz evening, but also for successfully integrating Ukrainian musician Volodymyr Vasilenko with two great British musicians, Alex Weston King and Jay Davis, using music as an international language. Inspiring. That was written by Peter Lydiard of Parchment Street, Winchester. Yep.
And the next letter is from John Bristow, Pothole Magic. Since I wrote to you about the lack of success locally with magic pothole paint, and which you published in letters on August the 22nd, we have had a notice from Hampshire County Council that carriageway surface repairs will start on our road on August the 30th. I now hope that this paint, as applied by Hampshire County Council, will finally bring a satisfactory outcome and reward our patients. Or is this as a result of the influence of your reader's letters column? If so, thank you for publishing my letter, and congratulations on the expected outcome. John Bristow, Kiln Lane, Otterbourne.
Richard, please.
Homes pressure from Tony Gaster. Excuse me. We see now pressure from government to build new homes. This has clearly got to happen. However, I've said many times that new estates must be linked to road improvements. There, of course, is a divided responsibility between city and county. The city of Winchester has hardly changed in the 40-plus years that I've lived here. The roads are now more congested than ever. Possibly the worst is the Romsey Road. All that slow-moving traffic wastes energy and causes pollution, so it's not an issue to ignore. Whether the vehicle movements are by EV or petrol diesel makes no difference to the numbers. What I feel is needed is a ring road around our city, or some means to go from east to west without going through the centre. Quite radical, but I don't see anyone wanting to give up their car soon, so someone has to manage the issue, or perhaps more radical solutions are needed. A car-free housing estate? Tony Gaster, Old Kennels Lane, Oliver's Battery, Winchester. but there's a note from the editor. This was a constant debate for many decades into the 1990s and featured in the local press. The powers that be decided that a ring road would simply increase traffic, and the better option was to reduce traffic in the city with the use of park and ride, public transport, cycling and walking.
Thank you, Richard. That's the end of our letters. Now, if you have an opinion... Oh, I'm told that there is another letter, is there?
Yes, from Eileen Berry.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, thank you, Deborah.
Yes, Eileen Berry, ludicrous about the hospital, ludicrous ideas. I would like to thank Philip Glassbrough for his very well put together comment in the Chronicle on August the 8th. Such a very precise sketch of what could happen and how ludicrous it is to close services at Winchester Hospital, such as A&E. It's well known that I have put forward at least four times the reasons why we should not lose its services. I think it's truthful to say that with all the consultation that has been done, for and against, which has been a waste of money, it's obvious what the conclusion would be. Because obviously if you live in Basingstoke and surrounding areas, you would say you want a hospital. As the population expands in that area, they're going to need it, with the idea of a new town being considered. So you do not need a crystal ball to understand the necessity for that area and further on. What about here, Winchester, and all the places that we know that are close to Winchester Hospital and are expanding? Barton Farm is yet to be finished, and I think that the army base is being considered for another 1,000 or more homes. This brings me to a point that is very serious, because there's no way that all these thousands and thousands of people, young and old, can get to the new supposed site. The law would say that for deaths that could be caused through no fault of the patient, it could be attributed to lack of transport and time distance. So where would we place the blame? If we have unnecessary deaths, really, if you could prove it, you could take the hospital trust to court. The timing of the consultations is suspect. It's usually within working hours. How can you honestly say that out of 200 people that attend the consultation, you've got your answers? Is that a true guidance to what the majority really want, which is thousands? Eileen Berry, Priorsdean Road, Hairstock.
Thank you, Deborah. Just checking round the room to make sure we have got to the end of the letters, and I think we have. Now, if you have an opinion or a subject you would like to air in the Hampshire Chronicle, you can contact them on 01962 860836. That is 01962 860836. Or you can email them news@hampshirechronicle.co.uk, or you could write to the editor at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester, SO23 8AL. Now we go on to the opinion piece, which is read today by Richard. It's written by Kimberly Barber
and is about the sad death of a mighty corse. It's a bit of news that sent shockwaves through the journalism community. After 60 years, the shorter journalism course at City of Portsmouth College, formerly Highbury College, has been axed. For those outside the industry, Highbury College in Cosham was once the breeding ground of many of the country's top journalists. Sky's Mark Austin, Times Radio's John Pienaar, BBC's Alex Forsyth, the Portsmouth News editor-in-chief Mark Waldron, Newsquest's very own head of editorial AI Jodie of Doherty Cove, plus many, many more, are included in its alumni. It used to run a very successful 20-week course, accredited by the National Council for the Training of Journalists, the NCTJ. It covered everything you'd need to get a job in journalism, court, law, public affairs, etc. It was a badge of honour to be able to complete everything required and get good grades in the short time frame. In recent times, this course was extended to 28 weeks, probably because so many found learning shorthand and reaching the dizzying speeds of 100 words per minute to get a gold standard so challenging. Over the years, it's run many variations of the course, all accredited by the NCTJ, with 6-month and even 1-year versions, with some even offering free places to those coming straight out of school. Many students spent time on placements with local news organisations too, either inspiring them to follow their journalism dreams or putting them off entirely. It was an effective way of ensuring that those who enter news do so with their eyes open to its all-consuming nature. Its course fees and shorter length appealed to many people who wanted to use it as a cheaper alternative to university. And even those who'd been through a journalism degree at uni often found themselves at the end of their course considerably poorer and still lacking the vital practical skills required by many employers. At one time, Highbury College was one of only four places in the country where you could get this sought-after diploma in journalism. However, last year, it was one of 62 courses run by 32 centres. Has this small centre lost out to the competition? Or is it a symptom of the merger between what was once Portsmouth College and Highbury College? Merging these two centres in 2021, on the face of it, looked like a good idea to streamline further education in the city, but it's meant that it lost the unique selling points of each individual centre. Only the college would know that. In a statement, the college blamed the small numbers of applicants. A dwindling number, perhaps put off by the hard work required, or perhaps unaware of the course entirely. From personal experience, it was usually the latter. I know through the amount of students asking to come into my new rooms for work experience, and from the amount of schools and students' requests signed up to by NewsQuest's Young Reporter Scheme, there's no shortage of appetite. Journalism still seems attractive, even if the marker of a good story is now judged by the amount of page views it gets rather than the amount of copies it sells in shops. While the axing of this rather unique small course will mean for journalism in general, will only be seen in years to come. I've already seen other courses, in particular news associates in London, stepping in to fill this void. Perhaps online training will now be the future? However, I still have serious doubts about how effective online shorthand tutoring is. As someone who regularly employs local talent and who spent 2 years on a multimedia course at Highbury, next to the journalism class, it's certainly a shame that this once incredible breeding ground has lost its way, been devalued and eventually shelved. The outpouring of shock on social media from right across the media industry should be enough to show that, albeit small, this course was mighty, and those who taught here should be proud that their legacy lives on through top quality standards stretching throughout the media.
Now we have editorial comment, please, read by Deborah.
Not all gloom for the future of our pubs. We hear a lot of stories about the closure of pubs, and there have certainly been a high number in recent decades as the way of life of Britain changes. Victorian Winchester had more than 100 in a city about a third the size it is today. In recent decades, many have shut for the last time, and often been demolished or converted into homes, shops or restaurants. Springing to mind in Winchester is the Heart in Hand, the Stanmore Hotel, the New Queen's Head, Chimneys, the Prince of Wales, the Star Inn and the Naval Volunteer. But it's not all gloom. The Flower Pots at Cheriton is celebrating being in the Good Beer Guide by the Campaign for Real Ale for over 50 years. And in this issue of the Chronicle, we also report signs of life at two suburban pubs in the city, the Roebuck in Full Flood and the March Hare in Hairstock. The number of pubs may be fewer, but the ones that survive are often in robust good health. The March Hare has been taken over by Jonathan Spencer, who's been having great success with the Rising Sun in Coldham Common and the Dolphin in Hursley. He clearly knows what he's doing. The days when pubs could offer only beer, a packet of crisps, a dartboard, and preferential service to the landlord mates are almost gone. Pubs have had to adapt to survive. Lots have done so. Some are now essentially restaurants, which is sad, but better than being converted into an upmarket home. But there are many others that, whilst evolving, are still essentially public houses, where anyone can go, walk up to the bar, buy a drink, chat to a local stranger about the weather or football or whatever comes to mind, although the age-old wisdom of staying off politics and religion is still good advice.
Thank you, Deborah. Now we'd go on to a couple of pieces written under the heading of Belgarum. This is an alternative look at the news. Jackie, have your first piece, please.
Yep. Reporters volunteer at community garden. Hampshire Chronicle reporters recently spent a day volunteering at a Winchester community pub. Toby Oliver and Seb Hoare were tasked with mowing and tidying the garden at Unit 12 in Winnell. The garden, funded by Winchester Rotary, was looking a little dishevelled, so the pair set to work mowing and strimming. It was a hot sunny day on Friday, August the 16th, the perfect day for working outside. However, the one thing the reporters failed to do was get the petrol lawnmower working, so the electric one had to suffice. Every year, reporters get a day to volunteer in the local community. Previously, reporters have helped at the Winchester Beacon in Jury Street and at the Winchester Bonfire Night. A Unit 12 spokesman said, "With the weather of constant rain interspersed with sun, the new garden has grown so quickly, if a little too much, and Unit 12 is reliant on volunteers to help us maintain it, so the users and local community of Unit 12 can enjoy it. Our aim is to start more gardening activities, and we welcome more volunteers and people to learn and dabble in the growing of vegetables and the maintenance of the garden. It's great for unwinding from the stresses of life, clearing that head, and forging new friendships, all while giving to the community." And for more details, including about volunteering, you can email admin@unit-12.com.
Thank you, Jackie. Now, the second piece under the Belgarum heading is Olympians' Resting Place. Among the numerous graves scattered in Winchester's Magdalen Hill Cemetery lies the tomb of Maureen Gardner, 1948 Olympic medalist, and Geoffrey Dyson, Gardner's coach and husband. Although the five entwined Olympic rings are deteriorating slowly, their legacy remains. Linda Nichols encountered Maureen and Geoffrey's grave while walking her dog. Linda's frequent visits to her parents, who are at rest in the graveyard, have familiarised her with the cemetery. It was on one of those visits she noticed the gravestone bearing the Olympic emblem and decided to investigate further. Her research led her to this discovery that the grave belongs to none other than two of Britain's most cherished Olympic heroes. Maureen Gardner was born in 1928 in Oxford. An illness which put her in hospital led to a drastic change in her career. She turned from ballet to athletics, where she was introduced to Geoff Dyson. Geoff Dyson was a pioneering athletics coach whose reputation led to his appointment as chief national coach to the Amateur Athletics Association. He trained more than 3,000 British coaches alongside a number of athletes. The most famous athlete Dyson trained was his future wife, Maureen. Gardner ran the 80 metres hurdles at the 1948 London Olympics at just 19 years old, placing her second after a close finish with Fanny Blankers-Cohen. She also helped Great Britain place fourth in the 4x100 relay. 1 month after securing silver at the Olympics, she married Geoff. The 1948 London Olympics were particularly important as they were the first sporting event following the World War II. As the war shook the world during the 1940s, two consecutive Summer Olympic Games were cancelled in 1940 and 1944. Money was at an all-time low and the solemn mood subsequently pervaded the country. Extraordinary achievements from athletes such as Gardner restored a new sense of hope and pride in Great Britain and helped the country recover from years of economic turmoil. Alongside her Olympic achievements, Gardner was a four-time AAA national champion in the 80 metres hurdles. In the 1950s European Athletic Championships, he once again placed second to Blanca Cohen in the 80 metres hurdles. Gardner became pregnant after marrying Dyson, ending her Olympic and athletics career. However, she returned to ballet and founded numerous children's ballet schools, including in Winchester. The Lewis Alsop School of Dancing was first established by Gardner in 1975 and remains a dance school which trains aspiring dancers. On September the 2nd, 1974, Maureen Gardner died of cancer, still in her 40s. Though she is no longer with us, her and her husband's legacy endures in Winchester. Right, now we now go on to items of historical interest, starting with Deborah, please.
Captivating allure has been enchanting for centuries. Abington Park, near Winchester, holds a captivating allure that has enchanted visitors for centuries. Lauded by William Cobbett as a pinnacle of natural beauty, this idyllic spot has retained its enchanting charm, its landscape still teeming with an abundance of wildlife. History whispers tales of royal indulgence there. It was at Abington Park that the charismatic King Charles II sought respite from the pressures of the crown, often in the company of his beloved mistress Nell Gwynne. As the grand project of constructing a palatial summer residence in Winchester under the masterful eye of Christopher Wren unfolded, the king found solace in the tranquil embrace of Abington. Sir George Bridges, a favoured courtier bestowed with the title of Groom of the Bedchamber and a generous annual stipend, graciously welcomed the monarch and his entourage to his estate in Abington whilst the plans were being carried out. In anticipation of Wren's architectural masterpiece, which was said to be adorned by a stately avenue leading to Winchester Cathedral, the king and his companions made Abington their temporary haven. To accommodate their royal guests, Bridges undertook an ambitious expansion of the Elizabethan house, culminating in the construction of a magnificent banqueting hall designed for opulent feasting and revelry. Nell Gwynne, the king's captivating companion, was treated with a level of opulence befitting royalty. Her private chamber was a testament to her elevated status, adorned with lavish gold wallpaper and furnished with a bed crafted from silver. The house's architectural splendour also extended to its exterior, boasting one of England's earliest classical porticos, believed to have been inspired by Wren's iconic design for St Paul's Cathedral. Subsequent renovations in the 18th century bestowed upon Abington House its Georgian façade, a testament to the evolving tastes of the era. George Bridges married the notorious Countess of Shrewsbury, who was often referred to as Pretty Witty Nell. She is said to have disguised herself as a page and held the horse of her lover, the Duke of Buckingham, when he fought a duel with her husband. No one knows exactly when the first dwelling was established, but the estate is said to have existed as long ago as AD 961, when Edgar, King of the Angles, is recorded as giving the house and five manses to Winchester Cathedral. Intriguingly, the estate was once owned by John Shelley, the younger brother of the renowned poet, remaining within that family's stewardship until the mid-20th century. Today, Abington Park stands as a living testament to its illustrious past. While privately owned, its grandeur continues to captivate, serving as a sought-after venue for corporate events, film and television productions, weddings and fashion photography. As visitors explore its enchanting grounds and gaze upon the historic house, they can't help but be transported to a bygone era of royal splendour and intrigue.
Thank you, Deborah. Richard, please.
Indie-inspired hoard at auction. A hoard of coins that was unearthed by a metal detectorist who was inspired by Indiana Jones is to be sold at auction with an estimate of £75,000. George Ridgway made the find in a recently harvested barley field in the grounds of Helmingham Hall near Stowmarket, Suffolk in 2019. The 34-year-old, who works for the family butcher's business, said he couldn't believe what he found. He said he called his father to guard the site until the arrival of an archaeological team when he realised the scale of the discovery. The collection of 748 gold and silver coins is estimated to date from as early as 206 BC through to the Roman Emperor Claudius in 46-47 AD. Mr. Ridgway said, "I was inspired by my childhood hero Indiana Jones to start history hunting when I was 4 years old, and I dreamed of finding a Roman hoard since my grandmother bought me a metal detector for my 12th birthday. It was an awe-inspiring moment when I realised that I'd found one." The proceeds from the hoard are being split between the landowner and Mr. Ridgway. When asked what he'd like to do with the proceeds, he said, "Well, firstly, I'd like to buy my dad a pint." More than 680 of the coins are to be sold at auction by Noonan's Mayfair in London on the September 18th, less 63 of them that were claimed by museums for their collections. Mr. Ridgway, who lives at Ashbocking, a few miles from the hall, said he decided to investigate an unusual crop mark in the field with his Garrett AT Pro metal detector. "I knew that a Roman road ran close to the field and was hoping two might be related, but after scouring the area, nothing turned up. I moved away 30 yards and recovered two early Roman bronze Colchester-type brooches dating from the 1st century AD. An other clear signal from the detector then revealed a silver denarius, a coin that had been inspired by Julius Caesar in 46 BC. It took 3 months to recover the hoard."
Now, thank you, Richard. Now, there's a lot with regard to what's on in our area coming up. Jackie, we have the first piece, please.
Yeah, hall date for female duo. Chris Weil and Julie Matthews, Britain's longest-standing female duo, are embarking on their most extensive tour yet after three successful decades in the music industry. On October the 18th, King Somborne Village Hall will be humming to the pair's enduring sound. The duo, known for their folk singer-songwriter style, have been nominated for numerous awards and have a total of 10 nominations from the BBC Radio 2 Folk Music Awards, snatching the Best Duo title in 2009. They've chalked up a massive 2,500 live performances, contributing to more than 100 albums and spreading their music to millions globally. 2024 marks the duo's 30-year milestone, and they are showing no signs of slowing down. Their energy remains robust, and the harmony between Chris taking up vocals, guitar, banjo, dulcimer and percussion, and Julie on vocals, piano, guitar, mandolin and bouzouki mirrors their vibrant career. The pair manage their own careers entirely, standing out in the industry as two empowered women doing it their way. In September, they will release their 13th studio album, Days Like These, which promises to weave through a breadth of topics and the full spectrum of human emotions. The sizeable event planned for October has special guests set to join the duo at numerous venues. Attendees can anticipate familiar tunes, unreleased tracks from their upcoming album, and the same soulful musical styling that has kept Chris and Julie at the forefront of the folk roots scene over the last 30 years.
Thank you, Jackie. My piece is headed André Rieu to perform. Audiences at Theatre Royal Winchester will soon enjoy a unique cinema concert by the world-famous violinist André Rieu. On September the 1st, the best-known artist of waltz will present his 2024 Maastricht concert, Power of Love. From his scenic hometown of Maastricht, Netherlands, audiences will experience a diverse mix of classical music, pop, rock and musical numbers, including film scores, waltzes, ballads and chart toppers. So to book tickets, visit the theatre's website. Deborah, please.
The festival that celebrates the past. The anticipation mounts as Heritage History Open Days returns to Winchester for the 9th consecutive year. Hampshire History Trust will celebrate the history of Winchester by putting on a number of events from September the 6th to the 15th. Local individuals and organisations run events, with Warren and Son commencing the Winchester Festival by displaying historical artefacts they once printed, including World War I trench maps and local directories of Winchester. On, it says Saturday, but I think it must be Friday, September the 6th, the Hampshire Chronicle will be participating in the celebrations opening its doors to the public between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. at 5 Upper Brook Street, Winchester. Visitors will get an exclusive insight into the newspaper's production, alongside the opportunity to ask the editor questions. For more hands-on people, St Mary's Church in Mitchell-Dever will be hosting a bell-ringing demonstration and a taster session on Saturday, September the 7th, between 10 in the morning and 12:30. Nikki Gottlieb, festival director, said, "I'm completely bowled over by the amount of interest we've received across the county this year. In the past 9 years, we've been coordinating the programme. The festival has just grown and grown, and with close to 200 events on our website, this is our best year yet. As always, our thanks go to all the amazing and enthusiastic organisers who set aside their time to take part. We're also grateful to our lead sponsor, Winchester College, for their ongoing support, as well as all our other sponsors, and to all the brilliant and hard-working volunteers who help to make this festival a success each year. I'm thrilled that we have so many exciting events and activities for all ages. If you've never experienced our festival before, then this is a great opportunity to learn about the history of Hampshire by coming along and discovering the hidden secrets of this county. It's jam-packed with great family days out, fascinating talks, and behind-the-scenes tours of places not usually open to the public. If you don't think history is interesting, the Heritage Open Days will change your mind. And I'm delighted to say every event is free. Book your place now, and with so many to choose from, you'll be spoilt for choice." Liz King, chair of Hampshire History Trust, said, "I can't recommend the Heritage Open Days Festival enough. It's a great opportunity to get behind the scenes. Buildings that you might walk past every day and have always wondered what goes on inside. And by doing so, you may well learn something new about our heritage from the stories that you will hear. With this year's optional theme of roots, networks and connections, the festival will feature several tours, including Winchester and the St James Way, walking tours with James Beddington on Sunday, September the 8th at 1:30. Starting from Essa Miles' Mosaic Studio, the walk will navigate the streets and history of Winchester, reaching its final destination at St Cross to complete part of Winchester's medieval pilgrim's route. Upon completing the walk and recording all the stamps along the way, participants can receive their own Heritage Open Day 24 Pilgrims badge. This event requires pre-booking, and fans are advised to book early as the popular events often sell out. Other special events include an exciting taste of what life was like as an Anglo-Saxon in 878 AD at the Ark, Winchester. A chance to visit all of Winchester's military museums, the opportunity to admire the MG Owners Club classic and sports cars display, and the ability to experience an open choir rehearsal at Winchester College. A detailed list of events can be found on the Winchester Heritage Open Days website. The Heritage Week will conclude in Winchester with a talk by Cheryl Butler on researching early black history. But the events don't stop there. The Mayor of Winchester has chosen the Heritage Days as one of his 2024-25 charities, meaning a programme events will continue throughout the year. These include a series of walks titled 800 Plus Years of Winchester's Mayors, a guided walk, as well as a buffet lunch at the Gandhi Restaurant, Winchester. For more information, visit ticketsource.co.uk/Mayor of Winchester's Charities.
Thank you, Deborah. And I might just add there that three of us round the table are members of the Cheswell Theatre, as are quite a lot of the readers on the Talking Newspaper. The Cheswell Theatre is taking part in this Heritage Open Week. So Saturday the 7th, the theatre will be open from 10:30 until 3 o'clock. Richard, please.
The Royal Marines Association Concert Band are going to be in concert with the Portsmouth Military Wives Choir at Romsey Abbey on the 7th of September. So after you've been to the church, go along there the day after. And at 7:30, and tickets are available from ticketsource.co.uk/musicinromsey, all one word.
To Jackie, please.
This is another article about the Heritage Open Days. History comes to life as doors open, and it's about Hampshire's history and all its richness being showcased in the Hampshire County Council headquarters by those who research its stories. Between September the 6th and 15th, heritage venues in Winchester and elsewhere will open their doors to the public in the ninth season of Heritage Open Days, HODs. Nearly 200 sites will offer a mouth-watering feast for local historians, archaeologists, conservationists, and the general public. HODs started in Europe in 1991, and a year later, Hampshire became one of the first, if not the first, UK county to follow suit. Under the leadership of local historian Leslie Burton, it got underway in Gosport, the little town with the big history. A dialogue has ever since taken place with another early contender, Berwick-on-Tweed, about which town actually was the first. Winchester Heritage Open Days, likely to be renamed Hampshire Heritage Open Days next year, was rescued from near extinction and built to its present extent by director Nicky Gottlieb, who after 9 years is handing over the helm. It is staffed by volunteers from another enduring legacy of hers, the Hampshire History Trust, HHT, with patrons explorer John Pilkington and TV historian Dan Snow. A key event during HODs is Showcasing Hampshire History, an event run by the Hampshire Field Club and Archaeological Society, HFC. It will offer a day-long come-and-go programme of talks with exhibits by HAT for archives, HGS for family history, and HIAS for industrial archaeology, as well as the Southampton Record Series and the new VCH. On show will be the work of local history groups from Alsford, Bitton, Eastleigh, Micheldever, Petersfield, Romsey, Titchfield and the Worthies. And there will be a chance to pitch ideas for publication to editors of HFC publications and Southern History. Former HFC president and editor of the Hampshire Papers, Dick Selwood, will outline the sorts of articles that fit the mould of various outlets, from a short news item to a full-length monograph, with examples from HFC's backlist, most of which is accessible online. Advice on publishing with the county's two flagship journals, Hampshire Studies, formerly the HFC Proceedings, and Southern History, will be given by Michael Hicks, a distinguished medieval historian and emeritus professor at the University of Winchester. The HFC Celebrating Hampshire Historian Project, covered in an ongoing series in the Chronicle, has fuelled studies by the present author and Dr. Roger Otterwill, who will talk on the popularisation of local history, much of it pioneered by the local press. Historians such as Thomas Shaw, 1840-1905, the loudest voice in the funding of the HFC in 1885, used the press not only to their latest studies, to air their latest studies, but also to promote a study of local history. A journalistic example of this genre is Southern Daily Echo writer Edgar Mitchell, 1887 to 1939, who wrote about Southampton under the pen name Townsman. Roger will show how local history, now reckoned to compete with fishing and football as leisure activities, went from an interest of the privileged few to a popular hobby. He will chart the proliferation of local history societies and changes in their activities spurred by social media and digital technology. It is often said that newspapers are the first draft of history. Well-known local historian Phoebe Merrick, who has been studying the history of Romsey for 50 years, has taken this to heart by researching the Chronicle's sister paper, the Romsey Advertiser, during World War II. In her talk, she will demonstrate how, by meticulously trawling the pages of the paper to which she frequently contributes, a detailed picture can be drawn of Romsey and surrounding villages during this troubled time. Her week-by-week abstract of events, both shocking and banal, even with wartime censoring, show how much went on as normal and how much changed forever. There are rare insights, both tragic and amusing, that reveal how people lived during the hostilities. A key presentation will be by Southampton historian Dr. Cheryl Butler, who uses local archives to tell the many stories hidden there. She's also talking in the Ark on September the 15th at 2 o'clock on Black History. Her talk will retell the fascinating life of a Hampshire adventurer, the chillingly named William Ghost, Elizabethan mariner, lodge-keeping housekeeper and privateer. Unlike the better-known sea dogs and explorers such as Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh, Ghost was one of that huge number of lesser men who made a living by travelling to the New World, fighting with the Spanish, and working for disreputable merchants. Nuggets of local and county history from her Little Book of Hampshire will be the theme of a talk by author Erica Wheeler. She edits Worthy History, the Journey of the Worthy's Local History Group, is a tour guide for Winchester and a professional blue badge tour guide for Hampshire, Wiltshire, Dorset and the Isle of Wight. Her book, written for Hampshire hogs and visitors alike, presents a wealth of quirky, unusual, little known aspects of the county, many drawn from findings of local history groups. She will explain how she researched and gathered a rich store of history, characters, landscapes and stories from the county. Digging is usually in the hands of archaeologists, but Fiona Ranger will explain how to dig up ancestors, so-called, from the wealth of sources now available. She is a professional genealogist and trustee of the charity Hampshire Genealogical Society, as well as its bookstall manager and liaison officer. Her talk will cover the full range of approaches to the subject, from the use of personal ephemera to official documents. This is not only an essential skill for family historians, but anyone who explores the past will sooner or later need to embrace it. She hints, you never know what you might dig up. History is said never to repeat itself, but recent riots show how it can get close. Under the heading Riots in British History, Hayden's Dictionary of Dates, published in 1868, fills an entire page of small print with a list of such events. In the earliest, in 1221 in London, the ringleader was hanged and rest had their hands and feet cut off. And nearly 650 years later, it was the turn of Wigan miners to riot. In Hampshire in 1830, the Captain Swing agricultural riots truly created mayhem with fears of revolution. Discontent flared up and triggered the authorities under Lord Lieutenant Arthur Wellesley, Duke of Wellington, to take rapid action. At Showcasing Hampshire History, plans for the forthcoming bicentenary commemoration of the riots in 2030 will be outlined by Bill Lucas, Professor of Learning at the University of Winchester and Chair of the English Project, and law journalist Edward, founder of the Hyde 900 Project, who is coordinating the project. The aim is to spread awareness of what happened, village by village, to engage communities in local research and hopefully to reenact the grand assize held in Winchester in the Great Hall in December 1830, when 300 men were tried, leading to mass transportation and some executions. Showcasing Hampshire History will be a free entry event held on September the 14th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. in the Hampshire County Council Elizabeth II building off Sussex Street, Winchester. For more information, contact David Roberts, ddroberts67@gmail.com or 01962 810 226.
Jackie, gosh, that was a lot of historical information there and talks. And I've got lots of bits and pieces coming up in the next few weeks as well. Thursday the 5th of September, there's a backgammon club. Apparently it meets every Thursday at the Winchester Hotel and Spa in Worthy Lane, Winchester. Friday the 6th of September, Kosover 25, a lecture and lunch at the Gurkhas in Kosover, and that's at the Gurkha Museum and Romsey Road, Winchester. Saturday the 7th, the Elton John Show, the Ultimate Tribute, that's at the Theatre Royal. Tuesday the 10th, Sing With Us, free sessions. We start rehearsals for our Christmas concert. Why not come along to two free sessions before you decide whether to join us? And that's the United Church, Jury Street, Winchester. Monday the 16th, Winchester on Film, screening of archive footage of Winchester Hampshire Record Office, Sussex, of Winchester at the Hampshire Record Office, Sussex Street, Winchester. Tuesday the 17th, Macbeth, a full-scale production, that's at the Theatre Royal, Winchester. Saturday the 21st, there are three things there on that day. Country Fair at St. Peter's Country Fair. Where is that? St. Peter's. Oh, St. Peter's Church, St. Peter's Street, Southampton. The second thing is Hidden Waterways of Winchester, a guided walking tour. And Holst the Planets, Charity Symphony Orchestra returns to Romsey Abbey to celebrate the 150th birthday of the composer Gustav Holst. Sunday the 22nd, the Worthies Makers Market. Wonderful event and lovely venue, shop for over 30 plus tables. I suppose that's sort of craft, is it? Says the makers. Tuesday the 24th, Winchester Film Society, Anatomy of a Fall, free film. Justine Treat, 152 minutes, legal drama, a lonely chalet in the French Alps, a dead man lying in the snow. That's at the, does it say, oh yes, the Science Centre and Planetarium. The last thing from me, Friday the 27th, Winchester Comedy Festival, that's at Winchester Theatre Royal. Right, and the last piece of what's on, just gone on a long time today, from Deborah, please.
Yes, this is quite short. Kate Bush Tribute Show. The award-winning show, An Evening Without Kate Bush, will host a distinctive celebration of the iconic singer at the Theatre Royal Winchester. The event, scheduled for September the 6th at 7:30, attracts both long-term fans and those who've recently discovered Bush through the Stranger Things phenomenon. All will gather to appreciate her influential music and the mythology surrounding her persona. The show, featuring legendary hits like Running Up That Hill, Cloud Busting and The Man with the Child in His Eyes, will also include unexpected B-sides, bootlegs and unique reinterpretations of songs like This Woman's Work and Babushka.
you, Deborah. Well, finally, before we go on to items of general news, let's have a look at the lighting up times for the coming week. The sun, if there is any, will rise at about 6:15 a.m. and set again at around 8 p.m. Right, well, we now have time to go on to items of general news. Deborah can have the first article, please.
And this is entitled Firefighters' Jobs Decline Across the United Kingdom. New data released by the Fire Brigades Union has revealed a significant decline in the number of firefighters across the UK, including Hampshire and the Isle of Wight. The figures show that Hampshire and the Isle of Wight Fire and Rescue Service has lost 435 firefighters since 2010, a 24% decrease. This is amid a national crisis with 12,000 firefighter posts axed nationwide during the same period. The Hampshire numbers are higher than the national average. One in five firefighter jobs, 21%, across the UK have been axed in the last 14 years. One in three fire control staff who take emergency calls and mobilise crews have been cut. The union warns that these cuts have compromised the UK's ability to respond to emergencies, particularly in the face of increasing climate-related threats. Response times to life-threatening fires have slowed by 3 minutes, from 6.11 minutes in 1995 to 9.13 minutes in 2023. England was the worst impacted, with 10,000 jobs cut, 22%. In the same period, Scotland lost 1,400 firefighters, 18%. Wales lost 500, 13%. And Northern Ireland lost over 200, 12%. Matt Rack, the General Secretary of the Union, expressed deep concern over the cuts. 14 years of austerity have devastated the Fire and Rescue Service. Every region has been hit, with 12,000 firefighters lost to cuts across the UK.
Wow. Thank you, Deborah. Richard, please.
Hundreds mourn dad of three lost at age 39. Hundreds of people turned out for the funeral of a dad of three who died after being diagnosed with a brain tumour at 39. A service has been held at St Peter's Church in Bishop's Waltham to celebrate the life of Ricky Smith. In March, Ricky from Bishop's Waltham was given 15 months to live, but died just months later. Mourners gathered in the village of Bishop's Waltham village centre before following the hearse carrying Ricky up to the gates of St Peter's Church. Accompanying Ricky's coffin was an arrangement of flowers spelling Daddy. Following the hearse was flatbed truck, marking Ricky's job as a ground worker, carrying arrangements of flowers and personal messages from loved ones. Among the floral messages were messages including "My son Ricky, my cuz and Rick's army." Ricky's family told the Daily Echo, the Chronicle's sister paper, "As a family, we would like to thank everyone for their love and support through our Ricky's journey. The love and generosity our Ricky has been shown from family, friends and local community has blown us away. We will be forever grateful. Our Rick was a loved boy, as you can see by the turnout of mourners today." In February, Ricky, who also has one stepson, started suffering headaches, which were initially dismissed as being due to lack of water and sleep. His fiancée, Katrina Binfield, 41, booked him an optician's appointment in March, thinking that he might need glasses. During the appointment, blood was found behind his eyes and he was rushed to the hospital where he underwent a scan. It was then found that Ricky had a grade 4 butterfly geoblastoma, a fast-growing and aggressive brain tumour. A fundraiser was launched by a family friend, which only a week after had already raised more than £75,000, reaching its goal. His brother said, "You fought hard and didn't go easily. I will always be proud of the way you kept your dignity and strength throughout this battle."
Thank you, Richard. Poignant piece. Jackie, please.
A Grade 2 listing offers protection for historic bridge. Historic bridge in Winchester has more protection after it was listed. Wharf Bridge on the Itchen Navigation at Wharf Hill is now Grade 2 listed following the work of Kieran Gillingham of the Itchen Navigation Preservation Trust, set up last year. Mr. Gillingham had been concerned about the structures connected with the Itchen Navigation, the canal that connected Southampton to Winchester from the 1760s to the 1860s. He said, "Wharf Bridge is an important access point and landmark in Winchester and the oldest surviving bridge on the Itchen Navigation. The original bridges that crossed the Itchen Navigation have almost all been replaced with modern structures, the exceptions being Wharf Bridge and Grade 2 listed Man's Bridge in Southampton." Mr. Gillingham submitted the application in August 2022, and it has taken 2 years to get listed status from Historic England. The Itchen Navigation Preservation Trust focuses on the preservation and improvement of the Itchen Navigation, along with communication about its features and benefits via the Friends of the Itchen Navigation Facebook page.
Thank you, Nikki. This piece has a resonance for at least three of us round the table because it says society gains freehold for its historic theatre. A Winchester Amdram company has secured the freehold of its venue, its home since 1962. Winchester Dramatic Society says it is delighted to announce acquisition of the freehold interest in the Chesil Theatre in Chesil Street. The Society applied in August 2023 for planning permission to demolish the next-door house for a long-awaited extension. Formerly the Church of St. Peter, the medieval building is listed. The Society has used it at no rent, but subject to keeping the building in good repair. After negotiations with the church commissioners and a public consultation last year, the ownership has now been successfully transferred. It is unclear whether the transaction has involved any payment. President Tom Williams said, "The Society has proved itself an excellent custodian of this historic building for more than 60 years, and this will of course continue. Transfer of the freehold gives us greater sense of permanence. We can look forward to our future extension plans with confidence." Chairman Stephanie Danby said, "We are grateful for the foresight of earlier members in taking the bold step of creating a new theatre in Winchester. However, our activities have certainly expanded since 1962 with a full seasonal programme as well as our thriving Chesil Youth Theatre and community outreach projects. We're currently bursting at the seams." 2 years ago, we bought land next to the Chesil Theatre for a much-needed annex, and a planning application has been lodged. Now we have taken a further step forward as freehold owners of the existing building. This enables us to ensure the continued visibility and sustainability of Chesil Theatre as a vibrant community arts centre. First mention of the building was made in the Winton Doomsday of 1148. St. Peter's Church became redundant after the Second World War and by the late 1950s was in a dangerous condition. At this time, Winchester Dramatic Society was looking for a permanent home. With assistance from Winchester Preservation Society, now the City of Winchester Trust, repairs were made and conversion to its present-day theatre. Members of the public can tour the Chesil Theatre on Saturday, September the 7th, as part of the UK-wide Heritage Open Day celebration. Chesil Theatre's opening season show, Last of the Red Hot Lovers, is now booking and runs from September the 28th of October. That's not right, is it? Right. From September the 28th to October the 5th. Open auditions for Jekyll and Hyde take place on September the 12th. Newcomers are welcome. Deborah, please.
Police dogs all set for Paralympic Games. Two Hampshire police dogs and their handlers are heading to the 2024 Paralympic Games in Paris. PC Paul Shuttler and PC Dan Atwood will be taking police dog Arlo and police dog Cody over to the event, along with many other handlers and search dogs from forces across the United Kingdom, to assist with making the venues safe for athletes and spectators. Thousands of athletes from across the globe will be taking part in sports from August the 28th to September the 8th. Millions of people are expected to watch the events. PC Shuttler said, "It's an honour and a privilege to represent UK policing as part of this operation for one of the greatest sporting events in the world. This summer, myself and PC Atwood will be heading to Paris to assist with the policing operation for the Paralympic Games with our explosive search dogs, Cody and Arlo. It will genuinely be an honour and a privilege to represent UK policing as part of this operation. Cody and Arlo might not be any good in the high jump or be able to throw a javelin very far, but they're absolutely best at what they do, and I think they deserve a medal as well."
Richard, please.
The RSPCA is concerned by the data on cruelty. Reports of cruelty to dogs in Hampshire reached a concerning 1,231 incidents last year, according to data released by the RSPCA. The charity has seen the number of such reports rise consistently each year. The year 2023 saw a total of over 52,000 complaints across the UK, compared to over 48,000 in 2022, signifying an 8% rise in just 1 year. The RSPCA highlighted these figures as it unveiled its summer appeal titled "No Animal Deserves Cruelty." They also shared the story of Dolly, a rescued chihuahua who, after suffering abuse, found a new and happier life. Chris Sherwood, chief executive of the RSPCA, said, "It's heartbreaking that more dogs need our help. We need to make a stand against this and say no more. Dogs are supposed to be man's best friend, yet more and more dogs are being subjected to cruelty every year. Dogs are the most popular pet in the UK, yet also the ones who potentially suffer the most. We would love to see next year cruelty going down. We know we can't do this alone, so our purpose is for everyone to work together to create a kinder world for animals. That's why we've launched our summer appeal, because it's vital that we all take action together to help animals like these dogs."
Thank you, Richard. Jackie, please.
Care home reopens after refurbishment. A care home has reopened following a multi-million pound refurbishment. The refurbishment was carried out at St Cross Grange Care Home in St Cross Road after it was purchased by Manor Life from previous owner Greensleeves Care in September 2023. Following refurbishment, the home opened in June. An open day was held at St Cross Grange on Wednesday, July 24th, allowing people to have a look around the newly refurbished home. The refurbishment has created a new interior designed home for 64 residents, including a secure dementia wing for 9 residents, with an attached sensory garden and dining room. All 64 bedrooms have luxury furnishings, flat screen TVs and ensuite wet rooms. Manor Life, which is part of the Nicholas James Group, also created new recreation and reception areas for residents, including a cinema room, a well-being room, hair and nail salon, and luxuriously furnished lounges on every floor. The top floor of the building has also been completely redone, with new rooms with ensuite bathrooms, creating 5 spacious bedrooms, all with ensuite wet rooms, lounge spaces and a kitchen diner area. Justine Thirlwell, Director of Operations, said, "We held a soft opening to introduce ourselves to the local community. We had a lot of people come around, about 24 or so, and we had people looking on behalf of their families or their parents or people who used to work at the care home coming in to have a look around. A few people are coming back for a private consultation because they have seen the house and thought it was the one. A lot of the staff are people who were working here when Greensleeves Care ran the property. They came back from the last owners. It is great to have them." Care home resident Hugh Powlett, who moved into St Cross Grange in June, said that it is very good. He said, "The care is amazing. I came here worried about the whole being shutting myself away from people and the outside world, but the staff have done their best to facilitate everything I've asked for and have all been lovely. The facilities of the home are very good. Sue Smith, who has worked at St Cross Grange for 6 years, said that the new owners have made the care home feel like a home away from home for the staff. She said, "The old staff and the new staff have gelled well together."
Thank you, Jackie. My piece is headed Music Review Continues. A review into the future of choral music at Winchester Cathedral is keen to hear from anyone who feels they can contribute. Bishop of Winchester, Philip Mount Stephen, ordered an independent review back in June after the resignation of Mark Byford, a senior non-executive member of Winchester Cathedral Chapter. Former Director of Music at Winchester Cathedral, Dr. Andrew Lumsden, stepped down at the end of July. Former choristers also expressed their fears over the departures of organist Claudia Grinnell and, in 2021, George Castle. The Bishop's Review is now organising in-person interviews. The process is being led by Patty Russell, an independent ecclesiastical lawyer. Winchester Cathedral has dedicated a section of its website to provide updates on the proceedings. On August the 22nd, it said, "Following the recent appointment of a co-reviewer, the Very Reverend Jane Hedges, to assist Patty Russell, in-person interviews are being organised by the reviewers throughout September and beyond to meet key cathedral staff. The people whom the reviewers wish to see and in which order is their decision, but you should feel it is important that your views are taken into account and that you have not been contacted in the next month or so. Be assured that the reviewers are keen to hear from anyone who feels that they can contribute." Deborah, please.
Reoffending data revealed. A third of criminals in Winchester reoffended within a year of their conviction or release from prison, new figures show. Charity Catch 22 said reoffending highlights the challenges within the criminal justice system, which struggles to effectively punish and rehabilitate offenders. This comes after the furore around Westview House, an ex-offenders hostel, where some residents were involved in drug dealing and threatening behaviour, prompting residents in the area to set up an action group, which led to the hostel's proposed closure next spring. Ministry of Justice figures show 473 offenders in Winchester were released from prison, cautioned, or handed a non-custodial sentence in the year September 2022. Of them, 158 went on to reoffend within a year. This included three under-18s. The reoffending rate in the area stood at 33.4%, up from 31.3% the year before. This was one of the highest rates across England and Wales. Nationally, the rate rose from 24.3% in 2020 to 21 to 25.8% in the October 2021 to September 22 cohort. Matt Randall, Justice Director at Catch 22, said, "Proven reoffending rates indicate that the system struggles to effectively punish and rehabilitate offenders, often due to limited resources and structural flaws. Systemic pressures such as staffing shortage, an overcrowded prison population, and ongoing impacts from COVID have further strained the sector." He added, "A more rehabilitative focus in the justice system was crucial to help reduce reoffending."
Deborah, Richard, please.
4-year path repairs complete. A major scheme to repair sections of the footpath along the Weirs is complete, following a 4-year programme. The repairs, funded by the City Council, with contribution from Hampshire County Council, were needed in order to remedy damage to sections of the riverbank following erosion. The work saw specialist contractors Robert Nicholas brought in to replace sections of decayed oak boards. Care was taken to not damage the river, a designated special area of conservation, with Robert Nicholas making use of a self-supporting temporary dam system to ensure as little impact as possible on the environment. It was a privilege to work in such a beautiful environment as the River Itchen for Winchester City Council.
Thank you, Richard. Nikki, please. Jackie, sorry.
Convenience store for petrol station. A petrol station's new owner has begun work to bring an off-licence and convenience store to the site. The pumps have been ripped out and the paving churned up at the landmark BP garage in St Cross, Winchester, after some residents in the area raised concerns about the effect the proposed Londis store would have on their neighbourhood. JP&S Services, which was bought from BP by Forecourt Emperor Viswanathan Yoganathan, has put up a sign saying, "Site closed for redevelopment, reopening soon. Sorry for the inconvenience." The garage is expected to be up and running again by late September. While some residents think that the sale of alcohol would exacerbate issues in the area, others believe the new shop will bring a convenient variety of vital items within walking distance in the St Cross area. One St Cross woman told the Chronicle, "Naturally, the residents of St Cross Road are not too happy with this news, which has been carefully kept under wraps. We would have preferred an M&S or quality outlet. We fought against alcohol sales at the garage some years ago, which is maybe why the news of the sale has been so carefully concealed." Another resident, Takita Blinden, 32, said, "I don't think it will be good. A lot of riffraff live in the building, a lot of drinkers and drug abusers. I wouldn't say it's a positive thing." But not all residents shared these fears. Jonathan Talbot Weiss, who lives opposite the garage, said, "I don't have a problem with it. I think if they do basic groceries, it would be fantastic. There are a lot of people who would be able to walk to the store instead of driving."
You, Jackie, don't get a name right this time. Right, the last piece that I've got of general news is headed "Amnesty aims to get knives off the streets." A knife amnesty scheme will allow people to claim compensation for surrendering zombie-style knives and machetes at a drop-off point in Winchester at the police station on Tower Street. Hampshire and Isle of Wight Constabulary will be part of a national surrender and compensation scheme for zombie-style knives and zombie-style machetes being launched by the government on Monday, August the 26th. The scheme will see one month surrender periods for owners to hand in their weapons and claim compensation, which will run until September 23rd. These items will be illegal to possess, sell, manufacture and transport from September the 24th. Chief Superintendent Claire Jenkins, for Strategic Lead for Serious Violence, said, "Tackling knife crime requires all agencies and partners working together, approaching this from a number of different angles. Our commitment to disrupt and tackle serious violence through Operation Scepter and ongoing work with the Violence Reduction Partnership has seen a reduction of nearly 8% for the number of knife crime offences in our force area when compared with last year. Knife crime can affect anyone, not just people in gangs. Young people say they carry them because of peer pressure or for protection. But in fact, you are much more likely to become a victim of knife crime yourself." Right, well, I'm sorry to say that's all that we've got for you this week. Before we go, another reminder that if you have any problems with your recording, the contact number is on the key fob attached to the memory stick. Would you please put the memory stick and the address label in the wallet when you have finished with it and return it to us as soon as possible. Well, thank you to all the support teams for the preparation and dispatch of this edition. And, of course, many thanks to my readers today. Deborah.
Goodbye.
Richard.
Bye.
Jackie.
Goodbye.
And from me, Peter, until next time, goodbye.